Hello, this is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics, and fashion. I'm Daphne Karnizis, standing in this week for Josh Bennett. Here's what's on the show.
This is a beautiful place. This is a place where people can grow, where they can regenerate, where they can be alive, where they can be reintegrated into society, really.
How is London tackling its homelessness epidemic, and what role can architecture and design play? In an extended roundtable discussion, we speak to the team behind London's only non-government-funded free homeless shelter to find out. And we head to the Greek capital to speak to the editor of an unusual pocket-sized publication, Desired Landscapes.
There's no one truth about the city. It's all about subjective observations. So this magazine, it's a mix of subjective observations and analyses.
All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Now, we can probably all agree that London is a city of extraordinary beauty and plenty of opportunities. However, among the challenges it still faces, one of the greatest is homelessness. Nearly 9,000 people have slept rough in the capital since April last year, an 18% rise from the year before. And with city councils and planners struggling to provide adequate numbers of council homes and affordable housing, homeless shelters have become a necessity. In 2007, Londoners Sheila Scott and Louis Salvoni decided to take matters into their own hands. They opened, funded entirely through donations and fundraising, what's still the capital's only non-government funded free homeless shelter. After years in a temporary space in King's Cross, last month they officially opened a new home, purposely designed by the architects Holland Harvey in Archway, North London, who transformed a disused supermarket into a safe and welcoming space. One that not only shelters people, but helps them deal with the challenges needed to move forwards. So how do you design a homeless shelter in a way that deinstitutionalizes it and gives it a sense of home? Monocle's Josh Fennett was recently joined here at Midori House by Sheila Scott from Shelter from the Storm, architect Richard Holland from Holland Harvey, and Demade Ward from Islington Council. Here's Josh.
Sheila, I'd like to start by talking to you and talking about the organisation that you set up in 2007, which is going to be the basis of our discussion about homelessness and design in the city. What is Shelter from the Storm and what's its main aim?
Shelter from the Storm is an emergency night shelter. That means that it's not a home, it's not a hostel. It's a place where we look after homeless people. We give them a bed, we give them dinner, we give them breakfast. We try to address their needs, try to help them find employment, somewhere to live, legal support for legal issues. We offer counselling. We offer ESOL classes. It's basically a holistic way of trying to help people move on and up out of the streets.
Dermot, I'm going to come to you at this point. Anecdotally, we're told that London is an extraordinary, prosperous, interesting place to live. But it would seem that we do have a problem with homelessness. How bad is that situation on the ground from where you're sitting?
The problem with homelessness across the capital is desperate. It's especially acute in inner London, especially in a borough like ours, like Islington. We have just under 14,000 households on our housing register. That's 14,000 households that are either desperately overcrowded, sofa surfing, in temporary accommodation. There's all kinds of ways you can be homeless. It's a desperate situation. We are building council homes as much as we possibly can. Islington Council ourselves are building 550 council homes between now and 2022. And along with housing association partners, we're building a total of 1,900 genuinely affordable homes across the borough. But it's not enough. There is too much red tape around the building of council homes. Austerity has changed things beyond belief. The housing benefit cap makes it so difficult to get somewhere to live in the private sector. And of course, most people in the private sector are not only faced with sky-high rents, they're also faced with very, very uncertain tenures. The biggest cause of homelessness in London right now is quite simply the end of an assured short-hold tenancy. Generally, they're 12 months long. At the end of the contract, a tenant here in the UK has basically got no rights. The landlord can say, I'm very sorry, but but you've got to go.
And when we're thinking about the design of spaces specifically for people who are homeless, to get offer them legal advice, to give them a nutritious meal, and even a simple thing that other people might take for granted, such as a quiet night's sleep where they felt safe, were there any design preconceptions, Jonathan, that you guys needed to question? The need, for instance, for wipe clean surfaces everywhere or a sterile environment that could change every evening? Was Sheila's experience of actually dealing with people and how they use these spaces informative to you?
Oh, massively. It was interesting what Dhiram had said, which was about kind of creating stable, kind of warm homes. It's like the same kind of goes for the design of a shelter. So it's at the heart of it, there is the kitchen. The kitchen is the kind of almost like the most primal thing that we do together. And so I guess learning from and seeing the shelter was actually worked the same way, which is that at the heart of it is a kitchen, and around that radiates these other functions. So they eat together. One of the main things that happens every night in the shelter is that there are these big communal tables and everyone sits together. So the idea that the volunteers would be in the centre cooking together, and then together they eat, and then from that everything kind of goes from there. And then kind of from there, you then start to have wider discussions, I suppose, about aesthetic and materials. And I suppose the big question is that how do you deinstitutionalize a space to ensure that sense of home, that you're not in a system, you're just somewhere secure where you can rebuild your life. And that radiated out into every kind of design decision that we made. At the end of the day, we were building this shelter within a challenging shell that was very much a shell. There was nothing there, so we had to create every aspect of it. So it was an amazing opportunity to say, well, what if you created from scratch a space, a place that could rehabilitate these people in the best way possible? Ultimately, we will need walls, we will need a floor, we will need lights. Well, they don't need to be, if we take that approach that we took to giving someone the most amazing experience in a hotel, why couldn't you take that same principle and ultimately then just spend, it's time. You spend a lot of time finding really cost-effective materials, or just finding suppliers who are willing to do it for nothing. And you have to speak to 20 different suppliers of that single tile, but you know that tile needs to have that right feeling to create a space. And if you don't find that tile, actually you won't help the guests in the way that they could, you could enhance that experience, and therefore hopefully with that stable base can build from a solid background.
So Sheila, to bring you in here, why has it taken so long for us to have a free homeless shelter in London, and how easy is it to find the kind of space that you need to then give Jonathan the floor plan to say, hey, let's get this thing going, let's humanise the space?
It was incredibly difficult to find the space. This is the fourth shelter that we've had, and hopefully it's going to be our permanent home. People are frightened of the homeless. There's a big narrative around homelessness. There's a lot of media, a very negative media narrative about the homeless. I believe that is because it's convenient to make people feel that the poor and the homeless are somehow culpable. If they were doughty, good working people and honest and decent, and they were, Lord knows what they would be, because a lot of them will be people that we all know. However, if they were somehow different, we wouldn't have this problem. And I don't know if other people use this word, but I call it othering. You can other people. You can make it feel like they're somehow apart from us, and therefore we don't really have to worry about them. And they will, classically, they'll use stories about it's all to do with drink and drugs and substance misuse and mental health. You know, I'm sure everybody can think of the arguments that we have about it. Our experience is that, and statistics bear this out, is that it is actually the horrendous rents and the terrible tenancy arrangements in the private rented sector, the lack of council housing that got sold off right, left and centre, and there was never the facility there to replace it. It's just not been replaced. Wages, minimum wage, which I refuse to call living wage because it's not a living wage, is not enough to live on. These are the real issues around housing, and we have fought. I can't tell you how hard it's been. It's probably this last 18 months trying to find somewhere. Even when we managed to get amazing people that helped us, we raised all the money ourselves, we managed to get a mortgage, we managed to do all of this stuff, literally getting people to let us build this beautiful place, it's been so difficult. There's been so much negative attitudes from people, and we are still, I think we're getting there. You know, we've willing hearts and minds, I call it, trying to show people, really, this is it. Look, it's nothing to be frightened of. This is a beautiful place. This is a place where people can grow, where they can regenerate, where they can be alive, where they can be reintegrated into society, really.
And just to jump in there, you obviously do amazing frontline work with convincing people that actually having this amenity close by will embellish rather than destroy the neighbourhood, and that there are human stories, crucially, to be told, not stories about numbers. One particularly galling and frightful thing is the increasing incidence of the so-called working homeless, so people that have until recently or continue to hold down full-time jobs, but through whatever legislative loophole or unfortunate circumstance, have ended up homeless while working, perhaps while supporting a family. Is this something born out in the kind of people that you see, which might challenge that view that of the more traditional, undesirable person?
We reckon that almost always a third of our 40 now, we've got 40 homeless people, or always a third of them, sometimes as many as 50% of them, will be in employment. Usually that will be for high street names. Sometimes it'll be 0 hours contracts. Sometimes it'll be, I mean, it's almost impossible to get yourself onto a stable pathway if you're on a 0 hours contract working for an agency. One of the things we'll do when we get people who are on this insecure employment, we'll try to get them a job with one of the decent employment partners that we have. We've built up partnerships with various employers who offer proper contracts of work at proper rates of pay. So we'll try and help them get better jobs. But actually, people just don't realise that the person serving you in the local coffee bar could easily be living in a homeless shelter or sleeping on a park bench or sleeping in their car. I mean, it happens.
You just need to go to any of our councillor surgeries in Islington to see that. I met a lovely gentleman the other week who was in full-time employment, living in his car. Couldn't afford anywhere else. I met two brothers in their 30s, still living in bunk beds in their parents' home. They couldn't afford to live anywhere else. And a mother living with her two children in a studio flat. The private sector, the rents are sky high, and it's insecure. Anybody can find themselves homeless, even those in secure full-time work.
And Jonathan, when I look at design in the public realm, I see a fairly bleak landscape of benches that mean you can't lie down on them, tower blocks with spikes around the bottom of them to discourage people from lingering. Is there any movement that you can see in architecture towards the genuine provision of public space that feels safe and that is not pushing people, I suppose, to liminal places, pushing people kind of out of the way and that is embracing? Or is that something that we should be thinking about building into our architecture practices and building into our commercial projects moving forward?
I guess a city where designers are being asked to create, I suppose, and always use your terminology, hostile environments for those that they don't want to be on their doorstep. I guess the public realm is about creating a space for the public to enjoy, and that's every part of it. Ultimately, rather than solving a problem of moving someone who wants to sleep in a doorway, rather than using spikes to move that person on, it should be dealing with the problem from the beginning and housing that person or finding them a route out of that situation. It feels like the spikes and the hostility in the public benches, which are designed to stop someone sleeping on that, is a symptom of a problem, not a solution to a problem. And I think there's a wider role, and I must admit this came up in the conversation in our talk, which is that architects, planners have a wider conversation to have with that client, that person is saying, you know, your client is saying to you, you know, we have this issue, how do we deal with it? Well, you say, well, perhaps this is a systemic problem that we can work together with local authorities to change the way in which we, you know, avoid that situation altogether, meaning that meaningful contributions are made towards, might we say, rather than spikes and spending this money on that, it's investing in a new fund for another homeless shelter. Ultimately, the homeless problem is growing. It's grown consistently over the last 10 years. And actually, it's that we need more places like Shelter from the Storm. And that comes from a different financial model. So rather than spending thousands on a designer to design you a beautiful, inhospitable public realm, why not spend that money on housing that person and giving that person support?
And of course, in the 1950s, the biggest architectural practice in Europe was actually at Greater London Council. So architects have played a massive part in creating all of the great council housing that we built post-war. And there are creative solutions around this. There is the talented people like Jonathan and many, many others in the industry, but we need the political will.
And just as I kind of bring us towards the end of the conversation, where I'm going to ask you each what we can learn from your work and what you would like to see to move it on to the next level, whether it's a piece of legislation, whether it is more teaching in architecture schools about the problem and not being exclusionary. I do want to talk about the discussion that you guys had with Ennismore, who are obviously a sort of partner in the project that you're working on, Sheila. How did that come about? And did that seem like a bit of a ray of kind of positivity on the project?
They contacted us and said, what can they do? And I said, well, you could help me build a new shelter if you really mean that you want to help. Yes, go away and speak to your people and come back to me. And, you know, they did. It was amazing. I can remember the call. I was in the car. I was really busy. I was trying to get this thing off the ground. I was just completely... And I just thought, oh, somebody else, you know, as I was a bit snitty, to be honest. But they were brilliant. And they said, yeah, you want to do that? We can help you do that. And they have. They've been brilliant. I mean, they've been absolutely brilliant. So good on them is what I say. So there is a will there, but I think that it's very difficult for people to know what to do. It is really hard. You need legislation. You need spaces. As I say, nobody wants to let you build homeless shelters anywhere. But I want to say something about this particular shelter, which we haven't said yet. What I hope from the design that we've managed to get with Jonathan and his team, that we've opened up the space. It was a grotty, disused supermarket. They hadn't paid rent for over a year. No, you know, it was not a... It was just a failed building. It was a failed whatever. With the undercrofts that were used for drug use, for lots of urine and, you know, very, very, very dangerous, unpleasant sort of environment. We've opened it up. We hope that the people who were frightened about homelessness can look in. They can see through the windows. You can see right the way through. Now, that was an important design feature. We don't want to be watching and spying on our guests, but we want them to feel safe. We don't want little corners where they can feel vulnerable. So we've designed it in a way, I don't think anybody would realise it's been designed like that, but it's really open and safe. People from outside during the day can look in, they can see what we're doing, they can see us playing pool, they can see there's nothing to be frightened of. The homeless are with us. They're hiding in bin areas in a street near you. Let's get them inside. Let's make the most beautiful space we can. That's what we tried to do. I think we've achieved it for remarkably little money, actually. We've made this beautiful space. We've made this spiritual space. And I don't mean that in a religious term. I mean that in the way that we've got this heart of cooking, of sharing, of fire. Everything is properly cooked. So there's all that symbolism, which, you know, tribal architecture and, you know, it's constant throughout all beautiful design, all beautiful cultures. We've got this wonderful spiritual space. It's beautiful. People come without judgment, without any conditions. The conditions are simple. You know, you cannot be violent. You cannot be drunk. You cannot be racially abusive. The simple ones you have in all your workplaces. Within that, we will offer you a space, a launch pad. We'll do everything we can. And this beautiful environment, we hope, our experience tells us it is a good way to do things, will help you move on somewhere that is more stable and safe for you. Whatever that is that you want it to be. That was the design brief that we gave them. And I think it's, well, fingers crossed, you know, it's new, but let's see how it goes.
And Dermot, I'm going to give the last word to you on this. You are extremely familiar with, I suppose, how this fits into the council as a whole, the issues, the numbers, and I suppose the political will. Is this shining example of something positive replicable? Is it something that we should be looking to roll out further? Or what would you like to see done?
Absolutely. This is just an example of some of the great things that can be achieved when the community actually come together and great organisations like Shelter from the Storm actually have the vision and the aspiration to do something like this. But we need more. We need government action. Most importantly, we need the government to cut the red tape around the building of council homes. There's no lack of political will to build council homes around the country, but we need the government to stop stacking the deck against us. And secondly, we need to urgently reform the private sector. We need to end these 12-month assured short-hold tenancies. We need to follow Berlin's example and bring in indefinite tenancies in the private sector so that those renting privately can actually have some certainty and security.
And a rent cap too?
A rent cap is something that should be considered. I think if we look at Berlin, I think indefinite tenancies will become a rent cap in itself.
A really great and important discussion there being had by some of the team behind Shelter from the Storm's latest project. To donate or take part in fundraising and find out more about the charity, you can visit sfts.org.uk. They've also got a great podcast that documents some of the stories of the people that pass through the doors of the shelter. It's called Shelter from the Storm, so check that out. Now, I was in Athens, Greece, last week, where a young graphic designer, Natasha Papa, was busy putting the finishing touches on the second issue of Desired Landscapes. That's the name of the biannual pocket-sized travel journal she launched earlier this year. She's the editor and creative director of the publication, and along with her team of contributors, takes us everywhere from Kuwait and Buenos Aires, Alexandria and Hong Kong, and of course her home city Athens, with plenty of good photography and intimate interpretations of these urban environments. I met up with Natasha on a hot summer evening in Athens' Monastiraki neighbourhood.
My name is Natasha Papa, and I'm a graphic designer, and now the publisher of Desired Landscapes. It's a biannual magazine. It comes every 6 months. It's all about cities, about readings of the cities. I chose the name, which is, I think, self-explanatory. It's the place that we would like to live or would like to visit, or maybe their fantasies that we have. So it's all about images, the image of the city.
Just on that point, since we're in Athens now, what do you think of the image of Athens as a city? Do you think it's a city that's somewhat it's understood, or do you think it's somewhat misunderstood and in terms of how people perceive it?
There's no one truth about the city. It's all about subjective observations. So this magazine, it's a mix of subjective observations and analysis through, let's say, architectural theory or journalism or, I don't know, literature. So it's all about a mix of subjective and objective.
And I think one of the things that really stood out to me when I first got my hands on your first issue was its size. It's very small, it's sort of almost pocket-sized. What was the intention behind that, and what do you think the effect of that is?
It's actually pocket-sized, and it's inspired from the city guides from the 70s, that they have really small size, very durable papers, and they have long texts. So I wanted to have a lot of text in this small format, and you can carry it around everywhere that you are, and be your companion without being really able to destroy it. So we chose very specific papers for that. That's why we chose to keep the same paper for every issue, because it's very, very durable.
Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you first become interested in cities and exploring cities?
I always love to walk in the streets. That's my favorite, let's say, environment. But I was a graphic designer. There was no connection to the city. But somehow I ended up to be in the Netherlands for my master's degree, where I got expertise into graphic design in relationship with public space. So we use the methodologies from architecture and urbanism or sociology, and we incorporated these in the design process. So through that, I had to, let's say, research a specific spot, like a street or a city or maybe a whole, I don't know, island or something, and come up with a problem and then design a solution for that. So I think through Desired Landscapes or through the other projects that I do, we try to improve the experience of the city and to attract more people into reading the cities and exploring the cities with their own eyes.
I've got the first issue here with me, and you're just about to release the second issue as well. But just looking at the first issue,
you've got a really diverse range of cities and of different topics. A few that really stood out to me, for example, the sort of short essay comparing Athens with Buenos Aires, which is, you know, me having lived and grown up in Athens, haven't been to Buenos Aires again. It's kind of a connection that I would never have thought to make myself. Tell us a bit about the piece you wrote, and also give us a bit of a sense of what kind of content we can see in the first issue.
First of all, it's all about the metropolis, so it's about main cities. We care about the urban environment and not really about nature, for example. So by having all these different cities in one issue, in one printed edition, you can have very apparent comparisons between them, and you can find patterns. And this is very, very visible in the Buenos Aires piece, because you could never think of comparing these two cities. So if you read the whole issue, you can find more links like that. And it's really funny to see how our own contributors, they started to discuss about this. And they started to discuss about Kuwait and Athens, for example. So it's a mix of diverse forms. So you can find from personal texts like poetry or something like a personal exploration of a city that we have here, like Berlin. Or you can have designers or creatives that they share their expertise perspective of theirs, like architects that they write about, for example, Athens. And we have here a piece about Athens, which is presented through a visual that we found in the archives of a museum. So it's all about a theatrical set. And through just one visual, we get a whole analysis of the atmosphere of Athens and how it's a fragmented city, full of cement. We also have some sections that are called walking width. So we choose the width with a person and see through their eyes. The Tokyo that you've mentioned is the city guide section that we always have. So we always have one city that we try to explore in a more experimental way, but through the eyes of a graphic designer. So Tokyo is more about the city grid and how the city is divided, how you can navigate without reading the signs, as you said. So it's all about a visual perception of cities.
And you mentioned some of the people that have written for you and you've collaborated with. How do you go about choosing who will write for you? What kind of backgrounds do your writers have? And obviously they're different people each time, right?
Some of them, they're the same. We have just a small team that are the same, like two people. And the rest, either I know through my professional network, so it's people that I have collaborated with, or they teach in some universities that I went. But also we use Instagram because we're really attracted through visuals again. So we find very interesting feeds. For example, for the second issue, we have the first piece, which is almost historic every time, which is about a collector in New York who has city guides from the 30s up to now. So we found this collection on Instagram and we felt that it would be very nice to have it in a print medium and give more space for analysis of these kind of objects, let's say.
That's really interesting. So taking something that sort of lives online on social media and bringing it to print form.
Exactly. And then you have to photograph the object like you want, and you have to, you know, to make the form of the text. So you expand a very small ephemeral scroll, let's say, in Instagram.
Thanks to Nathassa Papade, editor and creative director of biannual pocket-sized publication Desired Landscapes. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can always subscribe to this show's sister podcast, On Design Extra, available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, available on all good newsstands. This week's episode of Monocle on Design was edited by Kieran Banerjee. I'm Daphne Karnesis. Bye for now.